I'm Becky Quick, and you're listening to Squawk Pod.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod, the daily podcast brought to you by the team behind Squawk Box.
NYC, this is CNBC Control 2.
CNBC's essential morning show.
PCR 2.
Every day, get the best stories, debate, and analysis from the biggest names in business and politics.
All right, we're coming to it next.
Today, it's Jobs Friday. Unemployment at a 50-year low, but is it all good news?
You know, this kind of a mealy peach of a report.
Yuck.
Our panel on whether the economy is ripe for recession. Plus, tech billionaires turn on capitalism.
People that want to succeed, succeed. And I know it's not politically correct to say that.
To be honest with you, I think mathematically that's incorrect.
And Steve Schwarzman recalls his worst trade.
I realized I was about to cry. I'm just not allowed to cry.
The private equity legend tells Becky Quick about his early struggles and Becky's thoughts on that conversation, which you'll hear only on the podcast.
To hear this guy who you think of as making other people cry.
I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. It's Friday, October 4th, 2019. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning. Welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC. We are live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick, along with Andrew Ross Sorkin. Joe's out today. Our guest host is Steve Grasso. He is the director of institutional sales at Stuart Frankel. He's a CNBC fast money trader. He's a frequent guest here on Squawk Box.
And keep we've got going, a lot to keep mix going back.
And he's wonderful. And we love him.
It's the first Friday of the month, Jobs Friday, when the Labor Department releases the number of American jobs lost or created the month before, as well as the latest unemployment number. Jobs Friday is always on a Friday, and it's always at 8:30 a.m. So on Squawk Box, it's pretty much always a free-for-all.
There's nothing for me
the
there to go
right as well.
There are a lot of voices in this conversation, including our economics reporter Steve Leisman, plus all of the noisy traders behind our reporter Rick Santelli, who joins the team from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Andrew will walk you through the rest of our panel.
Joining us now, Austin Goolsbee in the Windy City, University of Chicago Booth School of Business professor and former Council of Economic Advisors chairman. It's great to see you, my friend. Kate Moore is here, chief equity strategist at BlackRock. Dave McIntosh is joining us, president of the Club for Growth and a former U.S. congressman. And it's great to have everybody here.
Let's get to Diana Olick. She has the numbers.
136,000 non-farm payrolls increased by 136,000 in September. The unemployment rate fell to 3.5%, down from 3.7%. That is the lowest level since 1969.
Diana, thank you. We're going to talk about all of this with some reaction from our jobs panel right now. Kate, let's start with you. We never put anybody on the spot with saying exactly what that number was going to be, but you were looking for a strong number, and this is.
This feels like a really solid number. The number I was going to give was 159 with some downside. I feel like, you know, 136 is a healthy number, especially because you saw the good healthcare number. We expected a little weakness in manufacturing and retail. I think that's kind of par for the course of where we are in the cycle. So I feel really good about this data, especially in light of what we had earlier this week in terms of the ISM. So I think equities will do well through the balance of the day.
Hey, Steve, you've had a minute to dig through some of that. What jumps out to you as the most important parts in this report?
I just was trying to see the last time we had a 3.5% unemployment rate, and it looks like you got to go back to 1969 for one. Look, here's the problem, and we sort of flagged this problem back in August, is that August is very typically revised higher. So the slowdown we thought we had in August at 130, which we thought was, hey, we're coming down to the place where we think we ought to be, that was revised up 168.
Yeah, never mind.
I like the revisions. I think those are good. I think that tells us that we're doing a little bit better than we thought we were doing. Retail has lots of problems, down 11,000 and then down 6,000. We have to watch that sector. There's a huge transformation, as you know, happening over there. Look, there's two scenarios that we're watching for here. Scenario number one is a sort of expected slowdown as the crazy 200-plus job gains of last year come back down to normal. If we can settle and call it a 125 to 150 range, that would be good. And we're more worried about the weakness going down below 100,000. I think the idea that we're now in a zone where it looks okay, it's pretty comfortable, it's not great, but it's not terribly weak, I call it a win.
Hey, Rick, walk us through the market reaction.
To me, the biggest news, without a doubt, is that the markets looked at it as good news, stocks and treasury yields, but it's really a bad report, and not for the job side. Wages, this is terrible. Unchanged month over month, under 3%. 2.9 on a year-over-year basis. These aren't good numbers. It's all about the money.
Austin, what do you think of this report?
You know, this kind of a mealy peach of a report, we're a little under what the forecast was. It's okay. Like Steve said, it's okay, but it's definitely not great.
Austin, though, you're looking at the wage issue, decelerating, not accelerating. How important is that to you?
I think it's pretty important. Now, that wages are steady after we've had several months where they were growing. Hopefully this is a blip. But, I mean, I'm telling you, the thing driving this whole thing is that the GDP growth rate is slowing down. And a lot of the forecasters are now saying that they expect a one handle for the rest of the year. If we get GDP growth falling down into the ones, I think the jobs numbers are going to fall apart and the wage numbers are going to fall apart.
Dave, what do you think? Growth expectations for the rest of the year, what are yours?
You know, I think they're continuing to be strong in the 2 to 2.5%. From a political standpoint, this is very good news. The fact the unemployment rate is an historic low, that's what most people around the country look at. And the job creation rate is averaging now at 160,000 a month. When you compare that to pre-Trump, the Obama era at 109, that's very good news that he can take to the public and say, we're going to continue to grow the economy, create jobs. And the wage, it's a slight downward trend in the direction, but it's still a positive increase rather than a decrease in average wages.
Sounds like a Goldilocks number to me. So it's you had everyone pick this apart. You had some weakness. Right. You had some strengths in it. It still gives the Fed some room for cover to cut rates.
That's
so
right.
I think this is as close to a not too hot, not too cold reading for the market. And we saw the market react to it almost immediately.
Yeah, I totally agree on the Fed bit here. I think if we had a number that was very, very strong and then everyone had to reduce their probabilities of further Fed accommodation or mid-cycle adjustments, I think that would cause risk assets to sort of shake. But this is right in that sweet spot where we're still growing, but we're not growing so fast, and the Fed can continue on that path.
It's difficult to think about a recession, as I said before, with a 3.5% unemployment rate. I know that every economist can pick through this. This is probably a tailwind for Trump. Wink, wink, head nod. But still, you know, at this point, it's about the economy, and for it to go this long, extended this cycle, really is a testament to how strong this overall economy probably is.
Hey, Austin, how quickly can these numbers change? How quickly would they change if we were actually seeing a turn in things?
I mean, if you go back and look at previous recessions, they could turn pretty quickly. And if a recession begins, the strongest part of the economy now is that consumer confidence and consumer spending remain strong. That can turn around very rapidly. In a space of just a couple of months, you can see big drops in consumer confidence. Now, it doesn't mean that it will happen, That's the reason not to just say, hey, well, $135,000 a month is okay, and so it's probably going to be fine. I mean, if we got in an escalating trade war, manufacturing's already in a recession, and retail is already in a recession. And those are two pretty decent-sized chunks of the economy. So we got to count on the other stuff really kind of maintaining itself. And the rest of the world, the U.S. is still doing better than all the other advanced countries. So it's not primarily about U.S. policy, but there are just a lot of dangers out in the world that everybody should keep their eye on.
Steve, what's the next big thing we look at in the markets?
Well, I think it's the Fed coming up. And obviously, China trade, we have to look at those talks. You have the Fed coming up. Those are
and then you have minutes next week.
And then you have earnings starting.
That's
so
right.
We haven't had anything to really dig into fundamentally for this marketplace. That's why we've been enamored with everything around it.
Right.
Once we start to see that there's not an earnings recession, the Fed, China, all of this could be a tailwind. And I don't think that we're going to have the same October, November, December that we had in 2018. That seems to me what everyone's worried about.
So you don't think we're going to drop 20% in the next 3 months?
So that's good, right?
That's a positive.
Right. But when you think about it, it's all about positioning in the marketplace. And I think that everyone got abundantly too negative based on what we saw in the last couple of months last year. And I don't think they're positive enough for the potential for the market to rip higher now.
And I just want to go back to the earnings bit here, because that's right. We're focusing so much on the trade talks that begin next week. But I think that the first reports from companies on third quarter earnings are going to be really important for equity market sentiment. We already know that 2020 numbers are too high and revisions are likely to come down. But if we end up getting a solid, you know, bit of guidance from companies as they report, maybe those downward revisions are not as stark. And then we'll have the opposite effect of what we've had over the last couple of weeks, which is a restoration of confidence in some of the corporate side.
Well, you've been talking. Our president's been tweeting. We'll let maybe Austin or Rick respond if there's something to say here. He writes, breaking news, unemployment rate at 3.5% drops to a 50-year low. He writes in all capitals. He says, wow, America, let's impeach your president, in parentheses, even though he did nothing wrong, exclamation point. Rick and Austin, you guys can go at it if you like.
Hey, I agree with
them. There's nothing
great
for me in there to go
at it,
so Austin can take over.
I agree with him. I said that the unemployment rate going down, that's excellent. When you get to the question of impeachment, let's save that one for another day.
All right, I want to thank our jobs panel today. Great to see everybody.
Cheese will be next.
Phew, you made it. Up next on Squawk Pod, capitalism in the crosshairs.
If you are not hitting your numbers for the shareholder,
right,
Nobody's giving you extra credit for nailing the other component parts.
And later, Blackstone's Steve Schwarzman on his early days as a captain of industry.
I'll give you 100. 100 what? $100 million.
This is Squawk Pod. Standing We're back by. With just Becky Quick, Andrew Ross Sorkin, and Steve Grasso now. Here's Andrew.
Hugh Andrew.
We have two tech CEOs speaking out this morning about the future of capitalism and wealth in America. Here's Salesforce's CEO Mark Benioff at the TechCrunch Disrupt Conference.
I really strongly believe that capitalism as we know it is dead, that we're going to see a new kind of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that new kind of capitalism that's going to emerge is not the Milton Friedman capitalism, that it's just about making money.
Right.
And if your orientation is just about making money, I don't think you're going to hang out very long as a CEO or a founder of a company. You have to be more than that in today's world. You certainly have to be more than that in San Francisco.
And that's
and
because
you certainly
need that
have to be more than
right?
that in our tech industry as well.
And Benioff later posed this question. He said, if trust isn't your highest value, then what is? And I think this gets to the whole question of shareholder primacy and what the Business Roundtable said. I don't know if he's right or if he's wrong. I think that
the key thing in what he said was, especially if you're in San Francisco, I think that's
very,
probably right.
But you
right.
know what? But the difference is, if you are not hitting your numbers for the shareholder,
right.
The rest of it, and I hate to say this, it doesn't matter. Nobody's giving you extra credit for nailing the other component parts.
Agreed.
Look at the CEO of eBay, by the way. They do all sorts of great things, and he's out. Why is he out? Because he's not hitting the numbers for the company. And so,
right, but we're going to the next step now. Even when they're hitting the numbers for the company, there's how much do
yes.
they need to make. So now we've.
But I don't know if it's you're saying how much do they need to make for the shareholders or
no.
how
much? How much does a CEO? So you have people weighing in saying you've made too much. You don't need to
compensation
make that much
on compensation. The compensation front.
Right. What's the right ratio?
I think that. Right. No, that look. That's a question.
And by the way, should there be billionaires, which is something that's been brought up.
That's the next stage. So everyone, once you get down that path, what I notice is billionaires are the first ones to say they don't want any other billionaires. They've already made it. They want to make it tougher to hurdle those jumps for the rest that are coming after them.
Well, let's jump in to one of those billionaires. Separately, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg held a surprise Q&A session with employees last night. He sympathized with Bernie Sanders' view on billionaires.
I understand where he's coming from. I don't know if I have like an exact threshold on what amount of money someone should have. But look, I mean, at some level, no one deserves to have that much money.
Zuckerberg compared himself to a robot who needs recharging and joked about the live stream. He said, at this point, I do such a bad job at interviews that what do we have to lose? Which I have to say, I think the more he steps out
and talks,
the better he is.
Better off he is. But we are in an interesting moment. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if it's about the company having to do more. I don't know if it's about taxes. Is that really the answer?
I think it has to do with the political winds.
Joe would laugh if he was here. We don't have enough people espousing the virtue of what capitalism can do, because I think that that's actually what is driving our whole economy and everything else, and that's the important part. I think the flip side of that is we haven't nailed how we collect revenue and how we spend revenue as a government to make sure that opportunities are equal and everybody has an opportunity.
I understand.
To get
and, that's the and even if we haven't nailed it, it's still better than the alternative
better
that you see around
right.
the world.
Better
right?
than the alternative, no question. The question is, can we nail it? And I think that's,
but
I think that's
what,
a real
what's
question.
What's happened to reasonable sorts of solutions to these things that you could get Democrats and Republicans to agree right. on? Things like extended the earned income tax credit, which Republicans and Democrats right. in the past used to talk about all the time as that being a very fair way right. of trying to do this and making sure that nobody falls below a living wage. Right. And ideas like that have been thrown out the window. We're just going to go after any success and take it down.
Right. But that's we also have get. To realize the middle class and the lower income earners are the wealthiest and have the most out
yeah,
of any
look,
other
even,
nation.
Even Steve Schwartzman.
Yeah, but that's a weak
Steve,
argument. You're not
it's a weak argument, yeah. but it's the truth.
Steve
it's
Schwartzman, truth. Who is a devout Republican, will come on the show and say that he thinks that the American dream is struggling, too. So that's not...
That's fine.
And I think the issue
is... And a lot
is,
of times, to be politically correct, you have to say
no,
that.
No, no, but I think even beyond that, I think there's a fair argument to be made that we have to figure out a way to actually make the opportunity piece equal. Because today, it's harder... It's
Do you
harder,
think the opportunity piece is not equal?
100%. And I think
where is it lacking? Where is the lack of opportunity?
Education opportunities.
Why is that, though?
Today, if you look at every...
Would you send your kid to a public school that had a low or failing rate if you had the opportunity to go?
Well, you should have the ability to get yourself into a position to succeed. But
the point is, if you're in the lowest quartile, the ability today to be in the lowest quartile and get into the next quartile, let alone the top quartile, it is materially harder to do today than it was 20 years ago and 30 years and 40. We have not improved. We've actually gone backwards. There's no that.
It's
that's
still better
not even
than it's
debate.
Still better than any other system that you can find.
Better right. than, but I'm saying it's not as good as it used to be. And so that's the when people talk
people
about
that want
the
to
American
succeed,
dream.
People that want to succeed succeed. And I know it's not politically correct to say that, and everyone wants to say.
I think
that
to be honest with you, in fairness, I think mathematically that's incorrect.
Save that tape.
Okay, we'll talk more about it.
Next on Squawk Pod, a revealing conversation with Blackstone CEO and Wall Street titan Steve Schwarzman.
I realized I was about to cry, and I was saying, I'm just not allowed to cry. I just can't do this.
Back after this. This is Squawk Pod, taking you behind the sounds of Squawk Box from CNBC. Today, billionaire Steve Schwarzman. He's co-founder and CEO of the Blackstone Group, a major private equity firm. With $545 billion in assets under management and a portfolio of companies that employ about 500,000 people. That makes him a sought-after investor, but also an advisor with an influence beyond Wall Street. Schwarzman recruited and organized the original CEO advisory panels that met with the Trump administration in 2017. He's also a prolific philanthropist, giving $100 million to the New York Public Library, $150 million to Yale, and $350 million to MIT to establish a new college of computing. Schwarzman's new book is called What It Takes, and it offers stark personal stories about his early career. Steve joined Becky Quick at the CNBC and Institutional Investor Delivering Alpha Conference last month. I caught up with Becky Quick about that conversation.
Look, people look at Steve Schwarzman and they see one of the titans in the industry, private equity, a guy who built this enormous firm that he's running. But you have to remember that all huge success stories start with people who are out there trying to bring in business. And Steve was really honest about how hard it was at the beginning. After being somebody who was successful on Wall Street, somebody who had been an investment banker and had done very, very well, to then going out and starting on his own. He and Pete Peterson were the two who did it. And these are both guys who had come from very lofty heights. Then when they were out on their own and they were entrepreneurs, it was a tough adjustment to get used to asking people for money and having them say no.
It was fascinating how vulnerable he is in recalling his early days.
He also told a story about how somebody almost made him cry when he lost money in one of those early ventures. And that was incredibly emotional. You really had the room kind of soaking it up to hear this guy who you think of as making other people cry as almost crying himself. And that was a tough lesson that he took in, too, that this is never going to happen to me again. His firm got better as a result because they really put in all kinds of checks and balances to make sure that you were mitigating risk in any and every investment that went through.
Right. No old, brave people in finance.
Yes, I think that was his line. That's right.
Here's Becky Quick and Steve Schwarzman, and they're speaking in front of a few hundred people having lunch, which is the background noise that you hear.
We started out in 1985, and we had a business plan to go into the advisory business because it didn't require any capital. We only put up $400,000, $200 apiece, and you could talk, and people would give you millions of dollars. Now I'm talking for free. But I've always gone backwards. But that was the first thing we wanted to do, and the second thing was to go into the private equity business. And then the third thing was to start new businesses, some of which have become, you know, like our real estate business, which is the biggest in the world now. You started when you saw, like, something really decline where it looked like an amazing opportunity that even as an amateur manager, I couldn't screw up. It would just happen by itself because your timing was right. If you could hire somebody who was a 10 on a scale of 10 to run it, and if the business itself generated intellectual capital that could make your existing businesses stronger. So that was the simple plan. And we're still just doing exactly the same thing, except we're doing it at sort of like much bigger scale than when you start, and it's just an idea. So as to what Becky asked me, as part of our second part of our strategy, we decided to raise a private equity fund. We sent out 500 little letters and offering circulars, and nobody called. You need enormous emotional stability because you get rejected so often. In our money-raising operation first fund, we got one yes and 17 no's. And, you know, we were completely dead. We'd run out of the big guys to go to see, and we had one left. It was the Prudential. And, you know, I was pitching my heart out. It was a Friday at the Pru. Garnett Keith, who was the chief investment officer, were there. That, in a way, was a privilege because usually you saw these, like, grundoons, you know, in the middle level of something, and they don't even care. He's the chief investment officer of the biggest insurance company in the world. I mean, this is like hot stuff. He looks at me and he says, "That's really interesting what you're thinking of doing. I'll give you 100. And I'm thinking, 100 what? $100 million. Wow. $100 million from the reference institution in the world. Everybody else except two people turned us down. And here is this man giving us $100 million. This is like visiting heaven.
Steve, let me ask you about some of the skills you've developed along the way. One of them is identifying talent.
You're looking for somebody who can hold the table. You're trying to figure out how big their brain is, how logical and how quickly and how seamlessly they can move from things to thing. How do they think deeply? How do they think about something that comes up that they don't know about? How do they handle that? Do they try and fake it? That's a bad idea, right? You always get caught. Or did they say, in effect, I really haven't studied that. I'm not familiar with that much. What is it you're interested in there? So that's like a good response, right? You know, and sometimes I'll walk in for an interview like most of you because nobody here has a dull life and you've just had some fascinating interaction with somebody. Some deal-oriented thing or whatever, and you're so excited, you say, geez, I just had the most amazing experience, because I get amazed easily, because a lot of things happen to me. And I'll just start talking about that. And you usually get a range of responses. One, like, what the hell am I doing in this room with this person? That's the wrong response, right? And it's sort of like, I'm inviting somebody into my world. And do they want to join it? Mm-hmm. Is it interesting? Do they have questions? Or do they sit there in sort of shocked amazement saying, this was not what I was expecting? Mm-hmm. That is also the wrong answer. Because in all of our lives here in this room, you know, there's always something happening that you weren't anticipating. So this ability to handle incoming stuff and take it in, make it into something, deal with it in whatever way, you know, you're comfortable, that's fine. So what you learn, and one other tip, is always keep your eyes locked on that other person, because the eyes are the window to the soul. And you can tell so much by just watching someone. They'll tell you who they are. And in a way, it's just like speed dating, right? Mm. How fast can you figure out that this person's a loser?
Speaking of that, what's the worst trade you ever made?
I green-lighted an investment in a company called Edgecom Steel. Mm. It was a steel distribution business. And we had no process. It was third investment. And so I made pretend. I was King Solomon. So I'm behind the desk and somebody walks in and you know, without really a written presentation, they say, I know this company. I work with them for years. They'll give us an exclusive and blah, blah, blah. And here's the multiple. And, you know, so that sounded pretty good. And then one of the other partners at the firm heard this was going on. Talk about mismanagement, right? He heard about it. So he came to my office. He said, this company is going to go bankrupt. 6 months later, we couldn't pay our principal and interest and lost all of our equity in the process. And one of my investors called and asked to see me. I sat in that wooden chair in front of his desk, and the guy started screaming at me that I was the most incompetent person he had ever met. And, you know, my face is getting red. And I realized I was about to cry. And I was saying, I'm just not allowed to cry. I just can't do this. Because this guy who was excoriating me was absolutely right. It was really a completely shameful moment. And I fought it off. I went, I had a cab in the parking lot, and I got in to the parking lot, and I looked around, and I said, this is never going to happen to me again. And as a result of that, what I would call colossal failure, we changed the whole way we approach investments. The rule is everybody has to interrogate that team. Everybody has to talk about the risks of an investment. Investing should be rational and orderly, collaborative, using everybody's experience and intelligence. So it makes working in an organization like that incredibly comfortable because you don't get blamed.
Steve, thank you very much. And thank you, everybody.
That's the show for today. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern.
Mark your calendar. Get your DVR ready. And do people even use DVRs anymore? As we see, it's like we're dating ourselves.
To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.